Felt the loss so strongly that you had, for it, risked seasickness, storms, and captivity. Well, here I am, and you ought to be satisfied. But besides, I have a particular reason for my visit this time. Her ladyship shuddered, for she thought that Felton had spoken. Never, perhaps, in her whole life had this woman, who had experienced so many strong and opposite emotions, felt so violent a beating of her heart. She was sitting down. Lord de Winter took a chair, drew it to her side, and seated himself upon it, and he produced a paper from his pocket, which he slowly unfolded. "Here," said he, "I wished to show you the sort of passport which I have myself drawn up, and which will serve as a kind of warrant in the life which I permit you to lead." Then, directing her ladyship's eyes to the paper, he read, "Order to convey to—" "The name is left blank," said the Baron. "If you have any preference, you will let me know, and, provided it be 1,000 leagues from London, your request shall be granted. So, I resume. Order to convey to blank Charlotte Baxon, branded by the justice of the Kingdom of France, but liberated after punishment. She will reside in that place without ever going more than 3 leagues from it. In case of any attempt at escape, she is to be put to death. She will be allowed 5 shillings a day for her lodging and board." "This warrant does not concern me," said her ladyship coldly, "since a name is inserted in it which is not mine." "A name? And have you one?" "I have that of your brother." "You make a mistake. My brother was only your second husband, and your first is still alive. Tell me his name, and I will insert it instead of Charlotte Baxon." "No, you will not. You are silent." "Very well. You shall be registered under the name of Charlotte Baxon." Her ladyship remained silent. Not now from artifice, but from fear. She believed that the warrant was to be immediately executed. She thought that Lord de Winter had hurried forward her departure. She suspected, even, that she was to go that very evening. For an instant, therefore, she imagined that all hope was gone, when all of a sudden she perceived that the warrant had no signature. The joy she experienced at this discovery was so great that she was unable to conceal it. "Yes, yes," said Lord de Winter, who saw what was passing in her mind. "Yes, you are looking for the signature, and you say to yourself, 'All is not lost, since the warrant is not signed. He shows it to me to frighten me, that is all.' But you deceive yourself. This warrant will be sent tomorrow to the Duke of Buckingham. On the day after, it will be returned, signed by his hand, and sealed with his seal. And 24 hours after that, I answer for it that the execution of it shall have been begun. Adieu, madam. This is all that I have to say to you."
"And I reply to you, sir, that this abuse of power, this banishment under a false name, are infamous."
"Would your ladyship prefer being hanged under your true name? You know that the English laws are inexorable concerning the abuse of the marriage contract. Explain yourself freely. Although my name, or rather my brother's, is mixed up in all this, I will risk the scandal of a public trial to be sure of my aim in getting rid of you." Her ladyship made no answer, but she became as pale as a lifeless form. "Oh, I see you would rather travel. Very well, madam. There is a proverb which says that travelling is beneficial to youth. Faith, you are right after all. Life is sweet, and that is the reason why I am not very anxious that you should take mine away. There remains, then, only the settlement of the 5 shillings a day. I am a little too parsimonious, am I not? But it is because I do not wish you to corrupt your keepers. Besides, you will still have your charms with which to seduce them. Try them, if your failure as to Felton has not disgusted you with attempts of that kind."
"Felton has not spoken," said her ladyship to herself. "So nothing is lost after all.
And now, madam, farewell. Tomorrow I shall come and apprise you of the departure of my messenger." Lord de Winter arose, bowed sarcastically to her ladyship, and left the room. Her ladyship breathed again. She had yet 4 days before her, and 4 days would serve her to complete the seduction of Felton. And yet a terrible idea suggested itself to her mind. Perhaps Lord de Winter might send Felton himself to Buckingham with the warrant, and thus Felton would escape her. For to ensure her success it was necessary that the magic charm of her seduction should be undisturbed. Yet, as we have said, one thing reassured her. Felton had not spoken. She did not wish to appear disheartened by the threats of Lord de Winter. She therefore placed herself at table and ate.
Then, as she had done the night before, she fell upon her knees and repeated her prayers aloud. And, as on the previous evening, the soldier ceased his beat and stood to listen. But she soon heard steps, lighter than those of the sentinel, approaching from the end of the corridor, and which ceased before her door. "It is he," she said, and she began the same religious strains which had so violently excited Felton on the previous evening. But although her soft, full, sonorous voice now thrilled more touchingly and more harmoniously than ever, the door continued closed. It did indeed appear to her ladyship, in one of those furtive glances which she directed to the little wicket, that she could perceive, through the close grating, the ardent eyes of the young man. But whether this were a reality or a vision, he had at least sufficient self-control on this occasion to keep himself from coming in. Yet, a few moments after the conclusion of her religious song, her ladyship fancied that she heard a deep sigh, and then the same steps that she had heard approaching retired slowly and, as it were, with reluctance. 55. The fourth day of imprisonment. When Felton entered the room the next day, he found her ladyship mounted on a chair, holding in her grasp a cord made of some cambric handkerchiefs, torn into strips, twisted together, and fastened end to end. At the noise Felton made in opening the door, her ladyship lightly jumped off her chair, and endeavoured to conceal behind her the extemporaneous cord which she held in her hand. The young man was even more pale than usual, and his eyes, red from want of sleep, proved that he had passed through a feverish night. And yet his forehead bore a serenity more austere than ever. He slowly advanced towards her ladyship, who had seated herself. He took hold of the end of this murderous woof, which, inadvertently, or perhaps intentionally, she had left unconcealed. "What is this, madam?" he asked coldly.
"That? Nothing,"
said her ladyship, smiling with that melancholy expression which she so well knew how to impress upon her smile.
"Weariness, you know, is the mortal enemy of prisoners. I was wearied, and therefore I amused myself with twisting this cord."
Felton cast his eyes up to that part of the wall where he had seen her ladyship standing on the chair, which she now was sitting on, and, above her head, he saw a gilded hook fastened in the wall which was placed there to support either clothes or arms. He started, and the prisoner saw him start, for though her eyes were cast down, nothing escaped her observation. "And why were you standing on this chair?" he asked.
"What does it signify to you?"
replied the lady. "But," insisted Felton, "I desire to know."
"Do not question me," said the prisoner. "You know that to us true Christians it is forbidden to speak falsehood."
"Well," said Felton, "I will tell you what you were doing, or rather what you were about to do. You were about to complete the fatal work which you meditated. Remember, madam, if your God has forbidden you to speak falsehood, he has much more emphatically forbidden you to commit suicide."
"When God sees one of his creatures unjustly persecuted, placed, as it were, between suicide and dishonor, believe me, sir," replied her ladyship, in a tone of profound conviction, "God will pardon suicide, for suicide then becomes martyrdom."
"You either say too much or too little. Speak, madam. In the name of heaven, explain yourself."
"What? Shall I relate my misfortunes to you, that you may treat them as fables? Shall I tell you my designs, that you may disclose them to my persecutor? No, sir. Besides, of what consequence can the life or the death of an unhappy convict be to you? You are only responsible for my body, are you not? And provided that you produce a dead body, which could be recognized as mine, no more would be required of you. And perhaps you might even receive a double recompense."
"I, madam, I!" exclaimed Felton. "Then you suppose that I would ever receive a price for your life? Oh, you do not think what you are pleased to say!"
"Leave me to myself, Felton, leave me to myself," said her ladyship, with some excitement. "Every soldier ought to be ambitious, ought he not? You are a lieutenant. Well, you would follow at my funeral with the rank of captain."
"But what have I done to you, then?" said Felton, much alarmed, "that you should burden me with such a heavy responsibility before God and men? In a few days you will be far from here, madam. Your life will then be no longer under my care. And," he added with a sigh, then you can do with it what you will."
"So!"
exclaimed her ladyship, as if she were unable to restrain her holy indignation.
"You, a pious man! You, who pass for a just man! You only demand one thing, and that is not to be inculpated, not to be inconvenienced by my death."
"It is my duty to watch over your life, madam, and I will do so."
"But do you understand the duty you discharge? It is cruel, even if I were guilty. But what name will you give it, with what term will the Almighty brand it, if I am innocent?"
"I am a soldier, madam, and I execute the orders that I have received."
"And do you believe that, at the day of final judgment, the Almighty will make a distinction between the hoodwinked executioner and the unrighteous judge? You will not allow me to kill my body, and yet you make yourself the instrument of him who wishes to kill my soul?"
"But I repeat to you," said Felton, much moved, "that no danger threatens you. I answer for Lord de Winter as for myself."
"Madman!" exclaimed her ladyship. "Poor madman, who presumes to answer for another, when the wisest, those who are the most after God's own heart, are afraid of answering for themselves, and join the party of the strongest and most fortunate to conquer the weakest and most miserable."
"Impossible, madam, impossible," muttered Felton, who yet felt in his heart's core the force of this argument. "Whilst a prisoner, you will not recover your liberty through me. Whilst alive, you will not lose your life by my connivance."
"Yes," exclaimed her ladyship, "but I shall lose what is much dearer to me than life. I shall lose my honour, Felton. And it is you whom I will make responsible before God and man for my shame and infamy."
On this occasion, Felton, impassive as he was, or as he pretended to be, could no longer resist the secret influence which had already enthralled him. To see this woman, so beautiful, fair as the brightest vision, to hear her by turns imploring and threatening, to suffer under the combined ascendancy of grief and beauty, was too much for a brain whose strength was sapped by the ardent dreams of an ecstatic faith. It was too much for a heart corroded at the same time by the love of heaven, which burns, and by the hatred of mankind, which destroys. Her ladyship perceived his agitation. She felt, as it were by intuition, the contending passions which burned with the blood in the young fanatic's veins. And, like a skilful general who sees the enemy preparing to retreat and then rushes upon him with a shout of victory, she arose, beautiful as a priestess of antiquity, inspired as a Christian virgin, with extended arms and neck uncovered and dishevelled hair, and with a hand modestly confining her dress upon her bosom, and with a glance illuminated by that fire which had already carried disorder into the senses of the young Puritan, she walked towards him, uttering to an impetuous air in that sweet voice to which she gave so terrible an emphasis, "To Baal his victim send, to lions cast the martyr, yet vengeance is God's charter, to him my cries ascend." Felton stood like one petrified.
"Who are you? What are you?" exclaimed he, clasping his hands. "Are you an angel or a demon? Are you Eloas or Astarte?" "Have you not recognized me, Felton? I am neither angel nor demon. I am but a daughter of the earth, a sister of the faith, nothing more."
"Yes, yes," said Felton. "I suspected it at first, but now I am satisfied."
"You are convinced, and yet you are the accomplice of that child of Belial whom men call Lord de Winter. You are convinced, and yet you leave me in the hands of my enemies, of the enemy of England, and of the enemy of God. You are convinced, and yet you deliver me up to him who fills and pollutes the world with his heresies and debaucheries, to that infamous Sardanapalus whom the blind call Buckingham and the believers Antichrist."
"I deliver you up to Buckingham? I? What do you mean?"
"They have eyes," exclaimed the lady, "and they will not see. They have ears, and they will not hear."
"Yes, yes," said Felton, drawing his hand over his damp forehead, as if to drag away his last remaining doubt. "Yes, I recognize the voice that speaks to me in my dreams. Yes, I recognize the features of the angel which visits me each night, crying to my sleepless soul, 'Strike! Save England! Save thyself! For thou wilt die without having appeased the Lord!' Speak!" cried Felton. "Speak! I can understand you now!" A flash of delight, fearful but rapid as thought, gleamed from her ladyship's eyes. Fugitive as was this homicidal glance, Felton perceived it and started, as if it had thrown light into the dark abysses of that woman's heart. He suddenly recalled the warnings of Lord de Winter, the seductions of her ladyship, and her first attempts on her arrival. He retreated a step, and drooped his head, but without ceasing to regard her, as if, fascinated by this singular being, he could not avert his eyes. Her ladyship was not the woman to misunderstand the meaning of this hesitation. In the midst of these apparent emotions, her icy coolness did not leave her. Before she was obliged, by Felton's answer, to resume a conversation which it would be so difficult to maintain in the same exalted tone, she let her hands fall, as if the weakness of the woman resumed its ascendancy over the enthusiasm of the inspired saint.
"But no," said she, "it is not for me to be the Judith who will deliver Bethulia from this Holofernes. The sword of the Eternal One is too heavy for my arm. Let me, then, escape dishonor by death. Let me find a refuge in martyrdom. I neither ask for liberty like a criminal, nor for vengeance like a pagan. To be allowed to die is all that I demand. I entreat you, I implore you on my knees, let me die, and my last sigh shall breathe forth a blessing on my preserver."
Before this voice, so soft and supplicating at this look, so timid and submissive, Felton advanced towards her. By degrees, the enchantress had resumed that magic charm which she took up and laid aside at pleasure. That is to say, beauty, softness, tears, and above all, the irresistible attraction of that mystical voluptuousness which is the most irresistible of all kinds of voluptuousness. "Alas," said Felton, "I can only pity you if you prove to me that you are a victim. But Lord de Winter makes most serious complaints against you. You are a Christian woman. You are my sister in the faith. I feel myself drawn towards you, I, who have never loved anyone but my benefactor. I, who have only found traitors and infidels throughout my life. But you, madam, you so really beautiful, you apparently so pure, must have committed many crimes for Lord de Winter to pursue you thus."
"They have eyes," repeated the lady, with indescribable softness, "and they will not see. They have ears, and they will not hear."
"But then," exclaimed the young officer, "speak! Oh, speak!"
"What, to confide my shame to you?" exclaimed the lady, with the blush of modesty upon her face. "For often the crime of one is the same of another. To confide my crime to you, a man, and I a woman, oh," she continued, modestly placing her hand before her eyes, "oh, never, never could I dare."
"To me as to a brother," pled Felton. The lady regarded him for a long time with an expression which Felton took for doubt, but which was, nevertheless, only observation and a desire to fascinate. A suppliant in his turn, Felton clasped his hands.
"Well, then," exclaimed the lady, "I will dare to trust my brother."
At this moment the step of Lord de Winter was heard, but the dreaded brother-in-law was not contented this time with merely passing the door, as he had done the evening before. He stopped, and, after exchanging two words with the sentinel, he opened the door and entered. Whilst these words were passing, Felton had rapidly moved from the lady's side, and, when Lord de Winter appeared, he was at some paces' distance from the prisoner. The Baron entered slowly, and let his searching glance travel from the prisoner to the young officer.
"You have been here a long time, John," said he. "Has this woman related her crimes to you? If so, I can comprehend the duration of the interview."
Felton started, and her ladyship felt that she was lost if she did not come to the assistance of the disconcerted Puritan.
"Ah, you fear that your prisoner will escape you," said she. "Well, ask your jailer what the favour was that I but now solicited of him."
"And were you asking a favour?" said the Baron suspiciously.
"Yes, she was, my lord," replied the young man, much confused.
"And what favor? Come, let us hear," added Lord de Winter.
"A knife, which she would return to me, through the wicket, an instant after she received it," replied Felton.
"'Is there anyone, then, concealed here, "'whose throat this gracious person wishes to cut?' "'inquired Lord de Winter, "'in a tone of mockery and contempt.
"'Yes, I am concealed here,' replied her ladyship.
"'I gave you your choice between America and Tyburn,' "'replied Lord de Winter. "'Choose Tyburn, my lady. "'The rope is, believe me, surer than the knife.'
"'Felton grew pale and made one step forward, "'for he remembered that, when he came in, "'the lady held a cord in her hand.
"'You are right,' said she, "'and I had already thought of it.'
"'Then she added in a lower voice,
"'I will think of it again.'
"'Felton shuddered, even to the very marrow of his bones. "'Lord de Winter probably observed this, for he said, "'John, my friend, distrust yourself. "'I have reposed my confidence in you. "'Be watchful. "'I have warned you. "'Besides, be of good cheer, my boy. "'In 3 days we shall get rid of this creature, "'and where I send her, she can never again injure anyone.'
"'You hear him?'
cried her ladyship, with a burst of indignation, which the Baron thought was addressed to heaven, but which Felton comprehended was for him. Felton held down his head and mused. The Baron took the officer by the arm, looking over his own shoulder so as not to lose sight of the lady whilst he was in the room.
"'Come, come,'
reasoned the prisoner, when the door was shut.
"'I am not so far advanced as I believe myself to be.' De Winter has changed his customary stupidity into unparalleled prudence. This is the desire of vengeance, and thus does that desire form a man. As to Felton, he hesitates. Ah, he is not a man of resolution like that cursed D'Artagnan.
Nevertheless, her ladyship remained in anxious expectation. She thought that the day would not pass away without her seeing Felton again. At last, in about an hour after the scene that we have just narrated, she heard some whispering at the door, and soon afterwards it was opened, and she recognized Felton. The young man came hastily into the room, leaving the door open behind him, and making a sign to her ladyship to be silent. His countenance was fearfully agitated.
"'What do you want?'
said she.
"'Listen,'
replied Felton in a low voice. "'I have just dismissed the sentinel, that I may remain here without anyone knowing that I have come, and speak to you without anyone overhearing what I say.' The Baron has just related to me a terrible tale. The lady assumed her smile of a resigned victim and shook her head. Either you are a demon, continued Felton, or the Baron, my benefactor, my more than father, is a monster. I have known you 4 days. I have loved him 10 years. Therefore I may well hesitate between you two. Be not alarmed at what I say. I want to be convinced. This night, after midnight, I will come to you, and you must convince me.
"'No, Felton, no, my brother,' said she. "'The sacrifice is too great, and I see what it will cost you. "'No, I am lost. Do not destroy yourself with me. "'My death will be far more eloquent than my life, "'and the silence of the corpse will convince you better than the living prisoner's words.'
"'Hush, madam,' said Felton, "'and do not speak to me thus. "'I am come that you may promise me upon your honour, "'that you may swear to me by that which is most sacred to you.' "'That you will make no attempt upon your life.'
"'I will not promise,' said her ladyship, "'for no one respects an oath more than I do, "'and if I promise, I must keep my word.'
"'Well,' said Felton, "'bind yourself only till I have seen you once again. "'If, after we have met, you still persist, "'you shall then be free, "'and I myself will provide you with the weapon you have asked for.'
"'So be it,' said her ladyship. "'For your sake I shall wait.
"'Swear it.'
"'I swear it by our God. Are you satisfied?'
"'Well,' said Felton, "'this night.' And he rushed out of the apartment, shut the door again, and waited outside, with the soldier's half-pike in his hand, as if he were mounting guard. The soldier having returned, Felton gave him back his weapon. Then, through the wicket, which she had approached, her ladyship saw the young man cross himself with delirious fervour, and hurry along the corridor in a transport of delight. As for herself, she returned to her seat with a smile of savage scorn upon her lips, and she blasphemously repeated the fearful name of that God by whom she had just sworn, without ever having learned to know him.
"'My God,' said she, "'fanatical fool! My God is myself, and whoever will assist in my revenge!'
56. The fifth day of imprisonment. Her ladyship had, however, achieved a half-triumph, and the success she had obtained renewed her strength. There was no difficulty in vanquishing, as she had hitherto done, men ready to be led astray, whom the education of a gallant court swiftly drew into her snares. Her ladyship was beautiful enough to fascinate the senses, and skillful enough to prevail over all the obstacles of the mind. But on this occasion she had to strive against an untutored nature, concentrated by austerity. Religion and penitence had made of Felton a man impenetrable of all ordinary seductions. Schemes so vast, projects so tumultuous, were floating in that fervid brain that there was no room for love. The sentiment that feeds itself on leisure and thrives and fattens on corruption. Her ladyship had made a breach by her false virtue in the opinion of a man prejudiced against her, and by her beauty in the heart and senses of a pure and candid man. By this experiment upon the most rebellious subjects that nature and religion could submit to her examination, she had at last taken the measurement of powers hitherto unknown even to herself. Often, however, during the evening, she had despaired of fate and of herself. We know that she did not invoke the aid of God. She trusted in the genius of evil, that boundless sovereignty which rules over the details of human life, and through which, as in the Arabian fable, a pomegranate seed suffices to build up again a ruined world. Her ladyship, being quite prepared to receive Felton, was at liberty to make her batteries ready for the next day. She well knew that only 2 days remained for her, that were the warrant once signed by Buckingham, and Buckingham would sign it the more freely as it bore a false name, and he could not recognize the real woman whom it concerned. This warrant, once signed, we say, the Baron would immediately embark her. And she knew also that women condemned to transportation use in their seductions arms much less powerful than those pretended virtuous women whose beauty is illumined by the sun of fashion, whose wit is vaunted by the voice of the world, and whom an aristocratic beam gilds with its enchanted light. To be a woman condemned to a wretched and disgraceful punishment is no impediment to beauty, but it is an insurmountable obstacle to power. Like all persons of real genius, her ladyship well knew what accorded with her nature and her means. Poverty disgusted her. Subjection deprived her of 2/3 of her greatness. Her ladyship was only a queen amongst queens. The enjoyment of satisfied pride was essential to her sway. To command beings of an inferior nature was, to her, rather a humiliation than a pleasure. She would most assuredly return from her banishment. Of that she had not the slightest doubt. But how long would that banishment continue? To an active and ambitious nature, like that of her ladyship, the days which are not spent in self-elevation are unlucky ones. What then can we call the days of bitter descent? To lose 1, 2, 3 years, that is an actual eternity. To return, perhaps, after the death or the fall of the cardinal, to return when D'Artagnan and his friends, happy and successful, had received from the queen the recompense that they richly merited for their services to her, these were the desolating thoughts which a woman like her ladyship was altogether unable to endure. Besides, the storm which raged in her breast was increasing in its violence, and she would have burst her prison walls if her body could have enjoyed, for a single instant, the same proportions as her soul. And then, in the midst of all this, she was goaded by the remembrance of the cardinal. What would be thought, what would be said, of her silence by that cardinal, so distrustful, so anxious, and so suspicious? That cardinal who was not only her sole support, her sole stay, her sole protector, for the present, but also the principal instrument of her future fortunes and revenge. She knew him well. She knew that on her return after a fruitless expedition, she might talk in vain of her imprisonment. She would in vain exaggerate her sufferings. The cardinal would answer with the mocking calmness of the skeptic, strong at once in power and in genius, "You should not have allowed yourself to be entrapped." Her ladyship then concentrated all her energy, murmuring forth in the intricacies of her thought the name of Felton, the sole gleam of light which visited her in the depths of that hell into which she had fallen. And like a serpent coiling and uncoiling its rings to satisfy itself of its own strength, she by anticipation enveloped Felton in the countless folds of her own inventive imagination. Yet time rolled on. The hours, one after the other, appeared to arouse the clock as they passed, and every stroke vibrated in the prisoner's heart. At 9 o'clock, Lord de Winter paid his customary visit, looked at the windows and bars, sounded the flooring and the walls, and examined the chimney and the doors. Yet during this long and minute investigation, not one word was uttered either on her part or on his.
"Come, come," said the Baron as he left the room. "You will not escape tonight."
At 10 o'clock, Felton came to relieve the sentinel at the door. Her ladyship now recognized his step, as a mistress recognizes that of her lover, and yet she both hated and despised this weak fanatic. It was not the appointed time, so Felton did not enter the room. 2 hours after, just on the stroke of 12, the sentinel was relieved. And now the time had come, and from this moment her ladyship waited with impatience. The new sentinel began to walk along the corridor. In 10 minutes, Felton came. Her ladyship listened.
"Observe," said the young man to the sentinel, "on no account whatever are you to leave this door, for you know that a soldier was punished for leaving his post for a moment last night, although it was I who kept guard during his short absence."
"Yes, I know that," said the soldier.
"I advise you, therefore, to adopt the strictest vigilance. For my part, I am going to inspect the room again, and to observe this woman who has, I fear, conceived some violent designs against herself. My orders are to watch her closely."
"Good," murmured her ladyship. "There is the austere Puritan telling a lie." The soldier smiled.
"Plague take it, Lieutenant," said he. "You are not badly off in getting such a commission, especially if your orders are not to go till she is ready for bed."
Felton blushed. Under any other circumstances he would have rebuked the soldier, who indulged himself in such a joke. But his own conscience was now criminating him too loudly to permit his tongue to speak.
"If I call," said he, "come in. And also, if anyone comes, call me."
"Yes, sir," said the soldier.
Felton entered the room. Her ladyship arose.
"You are come," said she.
"I promised to come," replied Felton, "and I have come."
"You promised me something else, though," said she.
"What then? Oh, my God!" said the young man, who, in spite of all his self-command, felt his knees tremble and his brow grow damp.
"You promised to bring me a knife, and to leave it with me after our interview."
"Do not speak of that, madam," said Felton. "There is no situation, however terrible it may be, that can permit one of God's creatures to destroy himself. I have reflected that I never ought to render myself accessory of such a crime."
"Ah, you have reflected," said the prisoner, again seating herself in her chair with a disdainful smile. "And I also have reflected."
"About what?"
"That I had nothing to say to a man who did not keep his word."
"Oh, my God," murmured Felton.
"You may leave the room," said her ladyship. "I shall not speak."
"Here is the knife," said Felton, taking from his pocket the weapon, which he had, according to his promise, brought, although he hesitated to entrust it to his prisoner.
"Let me look at it," said the lady.
"For what purpose?" said Felton.
"I will return it immediately upon my honor. You may lay it upon that table and stand between it and me."
Felton gave the weapon to her ladyship, who examined it attentively and tried its point upon the end of her finger.
"Very well," said she, returning the knife to the young officer. "It is a serviceable weapon. You are a faithful friend, Felton."
Felton took the knife and laid it upon the table, as had been agreed with the prisoner. Her ladyship's eyes followed his act with a satisfied glance.
"Now," said she, "listen to me."
The injunction was unnecessary, for the young man stood before her, waiting for her words, that he might feast upon them.
"Felton," said her ladyship, with a melancholy solemnity, "Felton, suppose your sister, the daughter of your father, should say to you, 'Whilst still young, and unfortunately beautiful, I was decoyed into a snare, but I resisted. Temptations and assaults were multiplied around me, but I resisted. The religion that I serve and the God whom I adore were blasphemed, because I called that God and that religion to my aid, and I resisted. Then outrages were heaped upon me, and, as they could not sacrifice my soul, they determined forever to defile my body. At last—"
Her ladyship stopped, and a bitter smile was visible on her lips.
"At last," said Felton, And what did they do at last?
At last, they resolved one night to paralyze that resistance which they could not overcome otherwise. One night, they mixed a powerful narcotic with my drink. Scarcely had I finished my repast before I found myself sinking gradually into an unusual torpor. Although I had no suspicions, yet a nameless dread made me struggle against this drowsiness. I arose. I endeavored to reach the window to call for help, but my limbs refused to support me. It seemed to me as if the ceiling lowered itself on my head and crushed me with its weight. I stretched forth my arms and endeavored to speak, but could only utter inarticulate sounds. An irresistible numbness stole upon me, and I clung to my chair, feeling that I was about to fall. But even this support was soon insufficient for my feeble arms. I fell first on one knee, then on both. I sought to pray, but my tongue was frozen. God neither saw nor heard me, and I sank upon the floor, subjugated by a sleep resembling death. Of all the time which elapsed during this sleep, I had no recollection whatever. The only thing I can remember is that I awoke and found myself transported into a circular chamber, most sumptuously furnished, into which no light penetrated but through an opening in the ceiling. There seemed to be no door to enter by. It looked like a magnificent prison. It was a long time before I could observe the place in which I was, or recall the circumstances which I now relate. My mind appeared to struggle in vain against the oppressive darkness of that sleep, from which I was unable to escape. I had some vague perceptions of a space passed over, and of the rolling of a carriage, but all this was so misty and so indistinct that these events appeared rather to belong to the life of some other person than to my own, and yet to be incorporated with mine by some fantastical duality. For some time, the state in which I found myself appeared so strange that I supposed it was a dream. By degrees, however, the fearful reality forced itself upon me. I was no longer in the house which I had inhabited.
This is the end of disc number 17. Please insert disc number 18. This is disc number 18.
For some time, the state in which I found myself appeared so strange that I supposed it was a dream. By degrees, however, the fearful reality forced itself upon me. I was no longer in the house which I had inhabited. As well as I could judge by the light of the sun, 2/3 of the day were already spent. It was on the evening of the previous day that I'd fallen asleep. My slumber had, therefore, lasted nearly 24 hours. What had happened during this protracted sleep? I arose, staggering. All my slow and torpid movements showed that the influence of the narcotic had not yet ceased. I found that my chamber had been furnished for the reception of a woman, and the most complete coquette could not have formed a wish that, in looking around the apartment, she would not have found satisfied. Assuredly, I was not the first captive who had been confined within that splendid prison. But you understand, Felton, the more beautiful the prison, the more was I alarmed. Yes, it was a prison, for in vain I endeavored to escape. I tried all the walls to find a door, but everywhere the walls gave back a dull and heavy sound. I went round this room perhaps 20 times, seeking some kind of outlet. There was none, and I sank upon a chair, worn out with terror and fatigue. In the meantime, the night approached rapidly, and with the night my fears increased. I knew not what to do. It seemed as if I were encompassed by unknown dangers, amidst which I must plunge at every step. Although I had eaten nothing since the evening before, my fears prevented me from feeling hunger. No external noise by which I could compute the lapse of time had reached me, but I presumed that it must be about 7 or 8 in the evening, for we were in the month of October, and it was quite dark. Suddenly the noise of a door turning on its hinges startled me. A ball of fire appeared above the window in the ceiling, casting a brilliant light into the room, and I perceived with horror that a man was standing at a few paces from me. A A table with two covers, with a supper all prepared, was arranged as if by magic in the middle of the room. And this man was he who had pursued me for a year, who had sworn my dishonor, and who, from the first words which fell from his lips, left me no hope of being at any future time restored to liberty.
Infamous, murmured Felton.
Oh, yes, the wretch! Exclaimed her ladyship, seeing the interest which the young officer, whose soul seemed hanging on her lips, took in this strange tale. Oh, yes, the wretch! He thought that it was quite enough to have abducted me in my sleep. He now came, hoping that I should yield to my shame, since that shame was consummated. He came to offer me his fortune in exchange for my love. Everything that a woman's heart can conceive of haughty scorn and of contemptuous speech, I poured out upon that man. Undoubtedly he was habituated to such reproaches, for he listened to me with a calm and smiling look, and with his arms folded on his breast. And then, when he thought that I had nothing more to say, he approached to take my hand. I rushed towards the table, seized the knife, and placed it to my bosom. "Take one step more," I cried, "and, besides my dishonour, you shall have to answer for my death." Doubtless there was, in my look, my voice, my whole appearance, that character of truth which carries conviction into the most wicked minds. For he paused. "Your death!" cried he. "Oh, no, you are much too charming a prisoner for me to consent to lose you so. Adieu, beautiful creature. I will wait until you are in a better temper before I pay you another visit." At these words he whistled, and the flaming globe which illuminated my room ascended and disappeared. I found myself once more in total darkness. The same noise of a door opening and shutting was, an instant afterwards, again audible. The globe of light descended anew, and I was once more alone. This moment was frightful. Had I been at all uncertain about my misery, every doubt was now dispelled before this fearful reality. I was in the power of a man whom I not only detested, but despised, of a man who had already given me a fatal proof of what he dared to do.
"But who was that man?" demanded Felton.
Her ladyship gave no answer to this question, but continued her recital. I spent the night upon a chair, starting at the least noise. For about midnight the lamp went out, and I was again in darkness. But the night passed away without any reappearance of my persecutor. Daylight came, the table was gone, and I still had the knife in my hand. This knife was my sole hope. I was overwhelmed with fatigue. My eyes were burning from sleeplessness. I had not dared to close them for a single instant. Daylight reassured me. I threw myself on my bed, still grasping the protecting knife, which I concealed beneath my pillow. When I awoke, another table was arranged. But now, in spite of my terrors, in spite of my agonies, a ravenous hunger made itself befelt. For 8 and 40 hours I had enjoyed no nourishment. I ate some bread and a little fruit. Then, remembering the narcotic mingled with the water I had drunk, I did not touch that which was on the table, but I went and filled my glass from a marble reservoir fixed in the wall above my toilet table. And yet, in spite of this precaution, I remained for some time in extreme anguish, though on this occasion my fears were unfounded. I passed the day without experiencing anything that resembled what I feared. I took the precaution, however, to empty the decanter of half the water, that my distrust might not be perceived. The evening came. But profound as was the darkness, my eyes began to grow accustomed to it. In the midst of this obscurity, I saw the table sink into the floor. A quarter of an hour afterwards, it reappeared, bearing my supper. A moment later, thanks to the same lamp, my apartment was again lighted. I was resolved only to eat of those things with which it was impossible to mingle anything somniferous. 2 eggs and some fruit composed my meal, and then I drew a glass of water from my guardian fountain and drank it. At the first mouthful it appeared to me no longer to have the same taste as in the morning. A sudden suspicion seized me. I stopped, but I had already swallowed half a glass. I threw the remainder away with horror and waited with the icy dew of terror on my brow. Some invisible witness had unquestionably seen me take the water from the fountain, and had taken advantage of my confidence, the more certainly to accomplish my ruin, so coldly planned, so cruelly pursued. Half an hour had not passed over before the same symptoms began to reappear. Only, as I had now taken no more than half a glass of water, I struggled longer against them, and, instead of sleeping soundly, I fell into that kind of slumber which left me the perception of all that passed around me, whilst it quite deprived me of the power of resistance or defence. I dragged myself towards my bed to seek the sole bulwark which remained, my guardian knife. But I could not reach the pillow. I fell upon my knees, grasping with my hands one of the posts at the foot of the bed. Felton became fearfully pale, and a convulsive shudder pervaded all his frame. "And what was more horrible?" continued the lady, her voice trembling as if she yet felt the anguish of that terrible moment, "was that on this occasion I was conscious of the danger which hung over me. My soul, if I may so express myself, was watching over my sleeping body. I saw, I heard, as in a dream, it is true, but my perceptions were on that account only the more terrific. I saw the lamp again ascending, and was gradually left in utter darkness. I then heard the sound of that door, so well recognized, although it had been opened but twice. I felt instinctively someone was approaching me. It is said that the wretched beings who are lost in the deserts of America thus feel the approach of the serpent. I wished to make an effort. I endeavored to cry out. By an incredible exertion of my will, I even raised myself up, but it was only to fall down again immediately. "But tell me, then, who was your persecutor?" exclaimed the young officer. Her ladyship saw at a glance how deeply she affected Felton, by dwelling on each detail of her narrative. But she did not wish to spare him any torture. The more deeply she wounded his heart, the more surely would he avenge her. So she once more proceeded, as if she had not heard his question, or as if she thought that the time for answering it had not yet come. "I heard him exclaim when he perceived me, 'Oh, these miserable Puritan women! I knew that they harassed their executioners, but I believed them to be less earnest in resisting their seducers.' Felton listened without uttering aught but a sort of roar. The perspiration trickled down his brow, and, with a hand hidden beneath his dress, he tore his flesh. "My first impulse on returning to myself," continued her ladyship, "was to look under my pillow for the knife, which I had been unable to reach. If it had not served as a defense, it might at least be useful for an expiation. But on taking this knife, Felton, a terrible idea suggested itself to me. I have sworn to tell you everything, and I will do so. I have promised you the truth, and I will tell it, though it should ruin me." "The idea suggested itself to you to revenge yourself on this man, did it not?" exclaimed Felton. "Well, yes," said her ladyship. "It was as you have guessed. That idea was not becoming in a Christian, I know. Undoubtedly the eternal enemy of our souls himself breathed it into my mind. In fact, how shall I confess it, Felton?" continued her ladyship, in the tone of a woman accusing herself of a crime. "That idea not only came into my mind, but had never left it since. And perhaps my present sufferings are but the punishment of this homicidal thought." "Go on, go on," said Felton. "I long to hear of the accomplishment of your revenge." "Oh, I determined that it should be as short a time as possible delayed. I doubted not that he would return on the following night. During the day I had nothing to fear. On this account, at breakfast time, I did not hesitate to eat and drink. I was resolved to pretend to sup, but to taste nothing. I must therefore, by the morning's nourishment, prepare myself to sustain the evening fast. I concealed a glass of water from my breakfast, as thirst had been my severest suffering when I remained 48 hours without eating or drinking. The day passed without producing any other effect upon me than to strengthen the resolution I had taken. But I took care that my face should not betray the thoughts of my heart, for I doubted not that I was watched. Many times, indeed, I even felt a smile upon my lips. Felton, I dare not tell you the idea at which I smiled. You would abominate me for it." "Go on, go on," said Felton. "You see that I listen to you, and I want to know the end." "The evening came," continued her ladyship, "and the usual circumstances took place. During the darkness, my supper was served as usual, and then the lamp was lighted, and I placed myself at table. I ate only some fruit and pretended to pour some water from the decanter, but drank that which I had kept in my own glass. The substitution was, however, so adroitly made that my spies, if I had any, could have no suspicion of the truth. After supper, I exhibited all the appearances of the drowsiness that I had felt the evening before, but this time, as if overwhelmed with fatigue, or as if I was familiarized with danger, I pretended to fall asleep. I had now found my knife, and, whilst I feigned to sleep, my hand convulsively grasped the handle. 2 hours glided away, without anything new occurring. On this occasion, oh my God, who would have predicted that on the previous night, I actually began to fear that he might fail to come. At last I saw the lamp gently rising and disappearing in the depths of the ceiling. My apartment became dark, but I made an effort with my glances to penetrate the gloom. About 10 minutes then elapsed, during which I heard nothing but the beating of my own heart. I implored of heaven that he might come. At length I heard the well-known creak of the door opening and shutting. I perceived, in spite of the thickness of the carpet, a step which made the floor groan. I saw, in spite of the darkness, a shadow which approached my couch. "Make haste, make haste!" interrupted Felton. "Do you not see that every one of your words burns me like molten lead?" "Then," continued her ladyship, "I collected all my strength. I called to mind that the moment of revenge, or rather of justice, had now arrived. I considered myself a second Judith. I held the knife in my hand, and when I saw him near me, then, with a last cry of grief and of despair, I struck him in the middle of the breast. The wretch! He had foreseen the blow. His breast was covered by a coat of mail. The knife itself was blunted. 'Ah, ah!' cried he, seizing me by the arm and tearing from me the weapon which had so badly served me. 'You want to kill me, my pretty Puritan. But that is more than hatred. It is ingratitude. Come, come, calm yourself, my charming girl. I thought you had grown gentler. I am not one of those tyrants who keep women in opposition to their wills. You do not love me? I had my doubts about it, with my usual folly. Now I am convinced of it. Tomorrow you shall be free.' I had only one wish, which was that he should kill me. 'Take care,' said I, 'for my liberty shall be your disgrace.' 'What mean you, my beautiful Sybil?' 'Yes, for as soon as I am free, I will tell everything. I will proclaim your violence towards me. I will proclaim my captivity. I will denounce this palace of infamy. You are greatly exalted, my lord, but tremble. Above you is the king, and above the king is God.' Master as he appeared to be of himself, my persecutor allowed a sign of anger to escape him. I could not see the expression of his countenance, but I had felt the trembling of his arm on which my hand rested. 'Then you shall never leave this place,' said he. 'Right, right,' I exclaimed. 'Then the sight of my punishment shall be also the sight of my tomb. Right, I will die here, and you shall see whether an accusing phantom be not even more terrible than the living enemy who menaces. But you shall have no weapon. There is one which despair has placed within the reach of every creature who has courage to make use of it. I will die of hunger.' 'Come,' said the wretch, 'is not peace of more value than such a war? I give you your liberty this instant. I will proclaim your virtue. I will call you the Lucretia of England. And I will proclaim you the Sextus. I will denounce you before men, as I have already denounced you before God. And if it should be necessary that, like Lucretia, I should attest the accusation with my blood, I will attest it.' 'Ah, ah,' said my enemy in a tone of mockery, 'then it is quite another thing. Faith, after all, you are very well off here. You shall want for nothing, and if you allow yourself to die of hunger, it will be your own fault.' At these words he left the room. I heard the door open and shut, and remained overwhelmed. Not so much, I confess, with grief, as with the shame of having failed in my revenge. He kept his word. The next day and the night passed without my seeing him, but I kept mine also, and neither ate nor drank anything. I was resolved, as I had told him, to let myself die of hunger. I spent the day and night in prayer, for I hoped that God would forgive my self-murder. On the second night, the door was opened. I was lying on the floor, for my strength began to fail me.
At the noise, I raised myself upon my hand. "Well," said a voice, which vibrated on my ear too terribly to be mistaken. "Well, have you become a little more compliant, and will you purchase liberty by a mere promise of silence? Come, I am a good noble," added he, "and although I do not love the Puritans, I do them justice as well as to their women, when they are pretty. Come, give me a little oath upon the cross. I ask for nothing more." "On the cross!" I exclaimed, raising myself up, for at that detested word I had recovered all my strength. "Upon the cross I swear that no promise, no threat, no torture shall close my lips. Upon the cross I swear to denounce you everywhere as a murderer, as a violator of honor, as a coward. On the cross I swear, if ever I accomplish my escape, to demand vengeance against you from the whole human race." "Take care," said the voice in a tone of menace that I had not yet heard. "I have one expedient, which I will only employ at the last extremity to stop your mouth, or at least to prevent anyone from believing a syllable of what you say." I rallied all my strength to answer by a laugh of scorn. He saw that from this time it was war to the death between us. "Listen," said he, "I yet give you the remainder of this night and tomorrow. Reflect. Promise to be silent, and wealth, consideration, honors even, shall surround you. Threaten to speak, and I condemn you to infamy." "You," I exclaimed, "you, to eternal, ineffaceable infamy." "You," I repeated. "Oh, I assure you, Felton, I believe that he was mad." "Yes, I," he replied. "Ah, leave me," I cried, "leave me, if you do not wish me to dash out my brains against the wall before your very eyes." "Well," said he, "you demand it. I therefore leave you till tomorrow evening." "Till tomorrow evening," I replied, sinking on the floor and biting the carpet in my rage. Felton supported himself with a chair, and her ladyship saw with demoniacal joy that the fortitude of the young officer would probably give way before the end of her recital. 57. An Event in Classical Tragedy. After a moment's silence, which her ladyship employed in observing the young officer who was listening to her, she continued her recital. "For nearly 3 days I had neither eaten nor drunk," said she, "and I was suffering dreadful tortures. Sometimes a feeling as of passing clouds, which pressed upon my brow and dimmed my sight, came over me. It was delirium. The evening arrived. I was so weak that I fainted constantly, and each time that I fainted, I thanked God, for I believed that I was dying. During one of these fainting fits, I heard the door open, and terror recalled me to myself. My persecutor entered, followed by a man in a mask. He was himself also masked, but I recognized his step, his voice, and that commanding air which hell has given to his person for the misfortune of mankind. 'Well,' said he, 'have you determined to take the oath which I require of you? You have yourself said that the Puritans are faithful to their word, and you have already heard my resolution. It is to appeal against you here on earth to the tribunal of men, and in heaven to the tribunal of God.' 'So, you persist?' 'Yes, I swear it before that God who hears me. I will call the whole world to witness to your crime, and will never cease until I have found an avenger.' 'You are an abandoned woman,' said he, in a voice of thunder, 'and you shall suffer the punishment of prostitutes. Tainted as you are in the eyes of that world which you invoke, try to prove to it that you are neither guilty nor insane.' Then, addressing the man who accompanied him, 'Executioner,' said he, 'do your duty.' 'Oh, his name, his name!' cried Felton, in a new burst of rage. 'Tell me his name!' Then, in spite of my cries, in spite of my resistance, for I began to understand that something worse than death was meditated against me, the executioner seized me, threw me on the floor, and bound me so as to wound and bruise me by his violence, and then, whilst I was suffocated by my sobs, almost senseless, and calling aloud on that God who would not listen to my cries, I uttered suddenly a fearful shriek of agony and shame. A burning instrument, a red-hot iron, the brand of the executioner, had been stamped upon my shoulder." Felton groaned. "Look," said her ladyship, rising with all the majesty of a queen. "Look, Felton,
how a new kind of martyrdom has been invented for a pure young girl, the victim of a monster's brutal crime. Learn to know the hearts of men, and henceforth be more reluctant to become the instrument of their unjust revenge. Her ladyship, with a rapid motion,